Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the From the Vine podcast. I'm your host, Bob Heifel, a reporter and writer of the From the Vine wine column for The Record in Stockton, California. I'm certified level 3 with the Wine and Spirit Education Trust and a part-time tasting room associate at the Lodi Wine and Visitor Center. I hope you enjoy this podcast, which focuses on the Lodi American Viticultural Area. I welcome your comments and reviews on our Facebook group page at recordnet.com/FTV209. And you can follow us at FTV209 on Twitter and Instagram. Welcome to the From the Vine podcast. I'm your host, Bob Heifel, and it is my great pleasure to have Jeremy Tredovic, the owner winemaker for Jeremy Wine Company in Lodi, California. Jeremy, great to be with you.
Thank
you
so much. Hey, I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for hosting me, Bob, and hey to everybody out there listening.
So we're taping this actually on Halloween 2019, October 31st, and harvest here in Lodi was a little bit sporadic. Some varieties came in, and then we had some stalling based on the weather, but things are pretty much completed now, aren't
pretty
they?
Much done. Most of the fields are picked at this point. We've got one little lingering field out there. It definitely was a weird year at the first part of the year, and this is pretty much consistent every year. You start going through that list of varieties and you start looking for something because we're all jonesing to start fermenting something. And so you're looking. And oftentimes, you know, this is kind of where like our sparkling came into play really early on, is we were just like, we're bored. Everything's prepped and ready. Let's find something to ferment. And so we went out and did a thinning on a field and turned that into a sparkling wine. But yeah, right now, this year was weird. We could not find anything to go. I think we were really maybe middle of September before we started getting multiple fields of ripeness. And we had many times in between that where our team was just kind of standing around like, hey, we've cleaned everything as many times as we can. We've painted. We're running out of stuff to do.
Right.
We had a couple new guys, too, that are like, really, you guys say harvest is hard, huh? This kind of seems like a lot of standing around.
They're spoiled. I don't know what's going to happen from here on out.
They felt it. They felt it. I reminded them of that as we got farther into it.
Yeah. We're going to jump all over the place because there's so much going on with your company and your winery, but I do want to talk about the future coming up, and you have designs on a new winery and facility tasting room coming up. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a really exciting process. We're definitely not giving up on our place downtown. We've built a great thing down there.
Yeah.
Having two locations will give us a lot of flexibility, and you know, we're still early enough in this process that there's a lot of things that can happen before getting built. I got to learn the complexities of construction and design because we're doing this really from scratch. It's a blank piece of ground with some vineyards on it. And it's been a very big learning curve. And I'm pretty strongly impulsive. When I get an idea on something, I want to move on it. And there's just no pushing. You have to just kind of work through the processes at the processes that things work through. Yeah. So
where is it going to be?
This is kind of out on the end of a Campo Road. We've got a spot out there that's going to be really beautiful. It gives us some latitude to create more estate, lots of grapes. We plan on replanting. There's about 11 acres currently planted out there in about 6 acres of Syrah and about 5 acres of Zinfandel. And we'll probably thin those up a little bit and start to plant in some of those varieties that we're regularly working with that I really enjoy. And it'll give us a little bit of latitude because this is fully estate fruit, which means we'll be able to make decisions purely based on that end product versus you know, looking at it from the selling it out in the broader market, which forces you to make a little bit different growing decisions.
East end of Ocampo or west?
This is the east end of Ocampo.
Okay.
East end, yeah, out towards Acquiesce Winery, off Elliott Road there.
Great, fantastic. Yeah. That's so exciting. And to kind of put in context how exciting this is for you is, I don't know if the growth, what the adjective would be for the growth of Jeremy Wine Company. I see it as meteoric.
Yes.
You know, you can tell us kind of,
We see it as frightening.
Meteors can be frightening.
Yeah, you know, when we first got started, I've been in the wine business a long time, and we knew the route pretty well. We thought we had a decent spot downtown for a tasting room. And looking back at it, we had a mix of perfect timing. There just weren't that many tasting rooms in the downtown. There weren't that many tasting rooms in the region. And we approached it with just a slightly different spin, and it worked for us, but it was incredibly scary getting going. We had very little free capital on hand. We had a very tiny line of credit. What I did have is I had a lot of design skills and wine knowledge that I could trade and barter to get some of those things, and a ton of connections in the wine business, which those were invaluable to reach out and have friends in the wine business that said, hey, I've got this little special lot that I don't have a home for, but you know, you can.
What
you
year know, are we talking?
We're talking 2009 and okay. 10 was kind of getting it off the ground. And the Kidders, when Kidder Winery was up and running, they happened to get started at the same time that we were getting started, and they were friends. And they later sold to Goodmills.
Goodmills, yeah.
And they were just so kind to us. They said, hey, you know, we'll trade you label design and a website design for a year of rent on each one of those things. And so that allowed us to get off the ground with very almost no cost in production as far as space goes. And it got us our AP, which is alternating premise. And that was absolutely critical because that's that point where it allows you to buy grapes and be able to bring them in and process and bottle and be a full winery, and then also have that type 2 license, which allowed us that tasting room downtown. So when we were first starting, I vividly remember my wife and I, we would work, our customers, design customers, expected us to be there from Monday through Friday. And then, of course, our tasting room was open Wednesday through Sunday. And so we were working 7 days a week. And I remember getting an argument with my wife, and I was telling her, we're going to be working 7 days a week. And she was not excited about that part. But there was times when it would get so quiet downtown. We had just a goal, like if we can just sell $200 today, if we have $200, we can make our rent and we can get through another day on it. And we would go out front and we would sit when there was nobody in the tasting room. We'd sit in our tables with sparkling water and pretend we were customers to try to trick people.
Try to get people in. To come in.
Yeah, because
it must be good.
Nobody wants to go to an empty restaurant.
Right. That's so true. Absolutely true. Wow. So the tasting room, that was your design studio, wasn't it?
That was the design studio. Uh-huh. And all the time that we had that, I think we moved into there in 2005, I believe. And there was this lot behind it. One of the old buildings on the lot behind us had the bathrooms had fallen off the building, and they'd only partially cleaned it up. So there's a bunch of rubble back in that space and weeds. And it was caged in on our side. And I would walk back there during our design meetings, and I would just drink some coffee and I'd think, wow, this would make a really great little outdoor park area for our studio where myself and our design team could sit and brainstorm ideas outside. And so that idea had always been kind of kicking around in my head. And as we got the tasting room up and running, I think we were in our first year and a half into it. And I finally had enough cash that I could think about working on that back area. And we called a contractor out, and he said, oh my God, what a pile of shit you've got out here. And it was one of those moments of like, you think you've got this beautiful thing in your hands, and
right.
People look at it and they're like, oh my God, that's hideous. Your child is something. And so I didn't listen to him, thankfully, and I reached out to a few other contractors, and they came out, got it done, and that has been one of the best things that we've done because it really created this quiet, private, little, distinct, hidden secret. We don't advertise it in the front of the building, and a lot of people walk into the tasting room and not even realize that's back
right.
there.
Yeah.
But it's like this little hidden garden back in the area. And that's one of the things I love. I love going out places and that sense of discovery and finding something.
Absolutely. So we're kind of, we're talking about your design background. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I have a really weird, and I think I actually have to start way back further beyond the design to make it all make sense. And I started out in 1994 working for Sebastiani and their cellar, which is Turner Road Vintners here in Lodi. And that's a big production facility. I think it was like 27 or 30 million gallons. And I was a cellar rat out there for a long time, ran all the processes, but it was all big winery production. And I got laid off just like most of the people do after seasons. And I think that was 97. And Nico Winery outside of Stockton was starting. And that was one of the first custom crush facilities in this area. And two cousins had bought it together, and one of them had a lot of experience in the wine business. And so I went out there, and I was bright-eyed, and I said, I want to learn everything about this business. Prior to that, working inside the big production, I was like, I'm getting the hell out of Lodi. I don't have any interest in staying here. And so they would call me Hollywood in the cellar. All right, Hollywood, when are you going out? And so then...
Big time enough.
Yeah, right, get out of Lodi. And then I went to Nico. And at that point, I had caught the bug, and I was really curious about what was happening. And luckily, they were a small enough startup company that they pretty much said, all right, yeah, you're in it. So I ran crews for about a year in the cellar doing process work, and we didn't have an assistant winemaker at that point in time. So for about 9 months, I got put into the lab, and I was doing wine processing. And winemaking today, I'm sounding like an old man.
In my day!
Back in my day! And it's true, because what we had at that point in time, like currently we have Lodi Wine Lab here in town, mm-hmm. and ETS is very accessible, and some of the other labs in Napa, and I'm sure there's more even locally around here. And those were not services that were easily accessible. ETS was available to us, but it's pricey. And so every single panel that you'd have to run that internally. And to run panels on residual sugar, that was a 16-step process. Right now they have auto titrators that you can just about plug the thing in and it'll do it and kick out a number for you. At that point, it was 16 individual processes, the Gold Coast method. And you'd have to add each one of these reagents and run through that process to get your final number out of it. And what I found is, thank God that I didn't go to school to be a lab guy, because I hated that work. It was repetitive, frustrating, redundant. And I remember the winemaker that time, Barry, and he said to me, he's like, you know, this isn't for everyone. You know, you have to have a certain mindset to enjoy this type of repetitive work. Uh-huh. And it was kind of eye-opening for me, because I started to look at the wine business in this kind of fractured set of skills that go into it. And from my own perspective, for my own happiness, I started to think, like, where do you fit in? What's those mm-hmm. spots that I'm going to excel? And I think that's a critical thing for just about everybody. For you to enjoy your job and your life going forward, you have to do a little bit of self-reflection. And I try to do this now with my team as well. I look at where people are succeeding and keep kind of testing them into more facets to try to find that spot where they really thrive and excel inside the company. So I moved out of the lab and I went into sales and marketing for Nico, and we started reaching out. And at that point also, the market wasn't hugely saturated with brands, and so distributors were receptive. And I think within the first year we had probably 8 or 10 different states that we were sending wines out to. So I continued on that for about another 2 years, a total of 4 years out there. And then Dave Phillips called one day, and I was ready for a change. And mm-hmm. so I said, hey, Dave, you guys looking for anybody? And he hired me for his West Coast Director of Marketing for Michael and David Winery. And this was at the point when they were just Phillips Farm still and just had started to introduce some of their more playful brands. Uh-huh. I was working for them, but it wasn't a lucrative position. They were still a very tiny company. And so I made a deal, and I said, hey, you know, if you guys will allow me 3 days a week to work on my own business, I'll give you guys the 2 days, but I'll totally give you the 5 days. If there's demand, I'll give you 7 days if we have stuff that we're working on, trade shows or travel, whatever needs to happen. And so I did that for them for about 2 years. And then my business started to grow, and I started a company called Vision Etching. It was a big bottle. So we'd have these magnums. They're like 3 liters, 5 liters, 27 liters. And this was compelled because I just found those things fascinating. Mm. And what I would do is I would sandblast them, and then I would hand paint inside the cutout, and I would replicate the label as it was for each of these wineries. And we'd sell those in auctions. I did that for about 2 years, and I got bored with it. And then I ended up selling it to an employee, and she took it over and she's run it for a while. And she's very, very, very creative. Uh-huh. But that kind of led into design. And design was, again, I can't remember if it was Dave or Mike. I remember Nick Sikiotis came to me one time for a poster for Groovin' in the Grove, and that was the first project I remember. And he said, hey, I know you can design this, you know, can you just design me out some cool, you know, artwork for Groovin' in the Grove? And so I took it on, and then I had a friend of mine that approached me, and Ben wanted a job. He was driving to a job, and he said, hey, I'm going up to Sacramento. It's working in a print shop. I absolutely... I'm not loving this at all. I hate it. Do you have anything I can do that will allow me not to go to work here? And so I hired him. And he's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant illustrator. Mm. It was like artwork was fluid in front of him. Gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. I was always very intimidated by the level of talent that he had for it. Well, when it came to etching or sandblasting or doing any of the other work that was more tactile, things that I was actually very good at, it was like he had two left hands. It, you know, he would destroy more bottles of wine than I could count. Like, wow, you really cannot do any of this. And so I brought in a computer and I said, well, you know, I think there's a market for winery design. And so we'll focus on doing design work for wineries. And so Ben really thrived at that. He passed away last year or so. And he was kind of the creator of a lot of the Michael David products. And I went back to Michael David and I pitched them on doing a retainer with us, and this kind of kicked us off. So they did a retainer and we did every piece of artwork that touched their brands, and we would just continue to work on it. And so Ben essentially was working internally for me, and we were going and just kind of looking for work inside Michael David. And over time we started to bring in other winery clients into the mix.
So did you work on like designs such as Seven Deadly? And
so we didn't do the Seven Deadly. Okay. That was done by Sally Kessler here in town. Also very talented. We would go through and do some tune-up work. We did extended, like, you know, box layouts for it. We did early versions of I think Earthquake is still current. Mm-hmm. Petite, we developed. I remember sitting at the table when we were talking about, like, you know, the first concept was Petite to Petite, and we developed a bunch of other things. We did a bunch of different brands inside their company, and they've later redesigned them and developed, as you do. Sure. And then we started to kind of work with a ton of other Lodi wineries. And I think that at that point we had moved downtown, and I think that's one of the big things that helped me get off the ground. When we were running the design studio, I would get so much grief from my team, my design team, because, you know, I would have a farmer that would come in and they'd say, hey, you know, I need to do this label, but I'm only doing so many cases, and, you know, I'm running broke on doing all this. And I'd be like, all right, I guess I'll do it for, you know, this price for you. Uh-huh. And then my team would be like, what the hell, Jeremy? Come on, man. We got to make a living in here. Right. You can't go doing that. But I think in the long run, it was a lot of favors that I put out there. And those were very, very helpful when we started working on our wine side of things, because those favors came full circle and right. People were very kind and referring back to us, or, you know, the grapes or wine or whatever else we needed, whether it was even just technical insights sometimes.
So there's a decision. There's a point where you decide that you want to have your own winery, and you and your wife Coral sit down, and what do you remember?
Absolutely freaked out. and it wasn't sitting. We were about, do you know where Avenal is?
Yeah.
Right in the middle of I-5 coming back from Paso Robles. So we had a few clients down in Paso Robles. And these were big corporate clients. And some of them I just weren't enjoying. There wasn't... My favorite clients were that farmer that would come in mm-hmm. and say, I want to do this. And I could look at him and I'd see, you know, a certain belt buckle, or I'd see a style, or they'd tell me things about themselves. And you'd say, I know what this drives this person. Mm-hmm. You know, it's horses. And so you bring in that little horse element into it. And they're like, oh my God, this is the best thing. And you get this immediate, like, emotional feedback out of that design work you're doing. I think everybody wants to be appreciated at some point in their work.
Yeah.
And so I think that part of it was very fun. And we are finding that our best paying clients in the design field were also the least fun to work on. They were corporate clients, and it would be, you know, repetitive meetings over and over to go over details. And that's just not a sweet spot for me. I'm not the guy to bring into a meeting every week to talk about the same details again. That's just a bad use of mine. There's somebody out there that'll do a great job at that. Uh-huh. It's not me. Uh-huh. And so we were driving back from Avenal, and I told Coral that I wanted to start this. And she had saved, it was our 10-year anniversary when we started. We actually opened the day of our anniversary. Wow. It was our first day open. And she had saved $10,000 way earlier, and we burned through that leading up to that opening day. Mm-hmm. And so she would always say, like, all right, you owe me 10 years from now, it's Paris, and you're gonna we're 10 years past it now, so this is our 20th anniversary. So maybe next year we'll pull
maybe
it off
now,
but,
yeah.
But that was the point that we started it.
Amazing.
Avanol.
So Who knew the driver would fly? I-5, I presume.
God, yeah. What else are you going to do out there? Talk about what you're doing.
Your future. But your future really has been incredible. We touched on it earlier. Meteoric, I think. Frightening, we said.
Frightening, yeah.
But you continue to come out with more and more varieties, blends, chocolate port, and then different, for lack of a better term, kind of distribution mechanisms or packaging for consumers. So obviously you're always thinking forward and looking at the market and seeing what works for you.
It's a lot of kind of throwing something against the wall and figuring out what your customers are after. The most successful wineries in wholesale, you have to work in large quantities. We work in mostly tiny quantities because we're really able to throw it in the tasting room, test it against our customer base and see what's working for them, and then adjust as we go forward based on that. And that's a lot harder to do when you're working with wholesalers. You really don't want to ship out a couple pallets or a container of wine and find out that nobody likes what you've done. And you're going to either ship it back or you're not going to be selling much to your customer anymore. But it is, I think it's the most exciting thing for me. I love the act of creating. I love that feeling of pulling a new product off the line, and here's this thing that you've been working on, and you've been working on it in 2D in a design space or in, you know, mock-ups in front of you, and all of a sudden here's this tactile real thing, and you can set it home and you can interact with it and pull a glass of wine. And so often what I'll do with our products is I float them out to our staff and try to see, and tell, I ask them, your payback to me for all the new product is, tell me how you're interacting with it. I want to know what your emotional interaction with this is. How are you feeling when you're doing this? Mm-hmm. What was the context that you found yourself going back to? Whether or not I'm using it in the grace, I probably would make a lot more money if I was in the big production side of things, but I enjoy the small stuff.
And tell us kind of what your overall philosophy is in winemaking. Is there kind of a house style, or do you not look at it that way?
I think there is a house style. I know there is a style. There's my palate style, and there are softer, more approachable wines. I think we've talked a little bit about the mechanics of winemaking, and this is a very individualistic mm-hmm. Product. Like, we all interact with wine at a different level. And I watched consumers in our tasting room. And when we first started, my wife and I had gone to a tasting room and we had been ignored out on the back of it until we were walking out the door. And we were virtually heckled on our way out the door. They said, why are you guys leaving the party so soon? You know, mm-hmm. get out of here. And it was a really crappy experience. Uh-huh. And so we kind of set our sights on doing great with hospitality. And you don't always hit the mark. You know, you do the best you can. There's context. And part of that was talking to your customers. And I tell my staff completely, like, nobody comes into our tasting room because they need a bottle of wine. That's absolutely not why they're showing up in the tasting room. If they need a bottle of wine, they can go to the grocery store and they can buy, you know, 1,000 choices. They're coming in because they want to get away from their kids for the day. They want to have a romantic afternoon. They want to, you know, learn something new. Mm-hmm. There's a whole variety of things. And that was part of what drove me. And to the winemaking style, I wanted to listen to our customers, and I really wanted to get a feel for what our customers are enjoying and appreciating. And I like soft, I like easy wines, I like oak. You know, these are components of winemaking that I feel are there. Now, you as a consumer, if these aren't your cup of tea, no problem at all. This is absolutely your right as a consumer to say, you know, that doesn't really fly for me. I like leaner, I like drier, I like, you know, whatever it goes in there. But as a winemaker, this is my expression. You walk into my tasting room and it's my kitchen. You've walked in and I'm going to serve you my stew, and hopefully it's something that you like and that you want a bottle of in the end of it. But that's what makes our industry so beautiful, because you can find if you want to dive deeper in wine and you really want to look for the latest trends or the things that are the most eclectic or eccentric, you can find those people that are absolutely just as passionate as you are about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what wine tasting is at its root for customers. I hope most people are doing this, is you're really exploring and looking for those wines or those locations and winemakers that are kind of pairing up with your innate palate tasting abilities. And I think that at the root of it, wine should be accessible. I think that it's the worst thing that we've done as an industry with wine is to make it something that makes people feel intimidated or stupid or not comfortable by making those decisions. Those are things that it's the last thing that you should have a problem making a decision on. We should make these things very approachable. And so we try to speak very simple lingo in the tasting room and feel out who your customers are. And I love it because I walk in and I can see an incredibly diverse range of customers in our tasting room when I go in, and it makes me really happy when I see that.
One of the things I love about Lodi is that when we go to a Jeremy or we go to some of these other wineries, there's just a plethora of choices. There's so many varieties that do well for growers here in this area and that winemakers like yourself that take chances, that are constantly looking and thinking outside the box. But how many varieties do you have now? You're well
that's,
over
that's
a couple,
a lot. Like 20 plus. I've probably made close to 30 different varieties. Yeah. And I think that this is a reason you go to a tasting room as well. Like, why not go to your grocery store? The grocery store is going to have room for, at max, maybe 4 different varieties in there. And in every one of these tasting rooms, you're going to find that little tiny lot of some oddball thing that they found on a piece of property, or it's going to tell a story that's a little bit different, or that may not be a commercially marketable product. And that's where you can discover in these tasting rooms. And I think that's a beauty. From us, I'm very quickly bored with process and routine. And I think it benefits our customers. In our wine club, we never repeat our wines. So we may have repeating fields over a year, but you're never going to find that repetition of variety, variety, variety. Mm-hmm. And part of that was born from not having any vineyards. If you don't have any vineyards and you're my personality, that means you're going to go vineyard, 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 grower, 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 variety, variety. Uh-huh. And if you have a set of vineyards in front of you that you own, you're more than likely going to want to process that fruit. It absolutely makes sense to pull that. And we'll see. Maybe in the future, you know, I will have my own property full of grapes and I'll be pulling everything out of my own fields. Mm-hmm. But chances are that I still will get bored and I'll still want to do something new and explore a little bit deeper too. So
what varieties do you like to work about? I remember you and I spoke, gosh, maybe it was a year ago already, the way time flies, but we were talking about Sangiovese.
I love Sangiovese.
And that's like one of your really, the wines you really like. And
number one variety for me. And it took a lot of repetition on it. And I think it's because it's an infinitely complex variety. There are so many different clones of it, and I think the Italians look at it more as like a family of grapes versus a single variety, because it can be so different based on the expression of whatever vineyard it's grown in and whatever farming process is applied to it. And I found this too, like every location you're going to find something distinctly different. I've told people about the Sangioveto that I had in the tasting room. And this was, I had gone up into Amador County, our very first harvest. I had picked a Brunello clone and a Chianti Classico clone. And these were more like Cabernets. They were distinctly different, but they had these little tiny tight clusters and just gorgeous, intense fruit, big tannins. And so I wanted to repeat that, but the vineyard had been sold. And I found another grower up there and I bought Sangiovese from him. And I was not really hyper aware of clones at that point in time. And they delivered them and I just looked at it and I was, you know, it's like your heart sings. Like, oh man, what am I going to do with this? And you pick up the cluster and the cluster is almost purple on the bottom of each berry and almost white on the top. They look like table grapes out of store. Great big grapes. And the clusters are like a pound and a half, nothing like what I'd worked with in the past. So I made wine out of it. Immediately, I was just, you know, let down. It's light, pallid, not very exciting wine at all. It was aromatic. I aged it out and I released it to our wine club members. And they loved it. They went crazy for it. And I was down to my last like 10 cases, and this old grower came into the tasting room and he said, "Holy crap, you got Sangiovese on your list. Like, Sangiovese is the most incredible, aromatic, and delicate feminine of all the Sangiovese varieties." Mm-hmm. And this was one of my very first big lessons in winemaking, which was I was looking at this through the wrong lens. Like, that wine was the correct wine. Those grapes were the correct wine. But I was applying a totally different and wrong set of expectations towards that wine. And I think this is the best lesson for all of us as wine consumers. I'm a wine consumer too. Uh-huh. Is that you have to look at wines in front of you and take that wine in your glass, not based on your expectations for what it is, but taste it, drink it, and enjoy it in the context that it is. Mm-hmm. Is it beautifully made? Is it fruity? Is it pleasing to your palate? I think those are the most important things to do. It's not incorrect to have expectations. Like, I really wanted this to be a big Zinfandel and it's lean and light. Well, that's okay. You wanted it to be a big one. But you also can ruin an experience for your own self. It's you. Mm-hmm. by having the wrong expectation. I was ruining my own experience with this wine,
right?
Not because I just wasn't able to access and appreciate that wine that was in front of me.
Yeah.
And so I've tried to take that in context as I've worked through, because the nature of growing grapes, the nature of wine, is that this is a fluid moving target. You know, we're not working with a static set of variables every year. And so every year we are granted a whole new set of parameters. And if next year turns out to be not that exciting, we get a lot of rain that comes through, the wine may be different, but I still can make a great wine out of it. Uh-huh. It just might be a different great wine.
Right.
And I think that's what I have to really always keep in context with myself and my team, is you have to look at your wine and say, did I make a great product? This is interesting. Not, why doesn't this have the most richest of color or giant tannins? Or, you know, I have this other expectation there. Mm-hmm. In 2011, we had a wet year and we had Barbera that came in from one of our fields. And this field is quite old. It's 40 something years old. And the grapes, just the action of the pickers picking them and dropping them into those little bins, the picking tubs, split the clusters open. And so by the time the bins came into our winery, they literally had a layer of 2 inches of clear juice over the top of these because they had just smashed down the bin so much. Uh-huh. Again, that's like heartbreak. You're like, oh, God, this is going to be terrible. Uh-huh. And this made one of our most popular wines that I have ever released in that tasting room, which was a thin, perfumy Pinot Noir-like Barbera. Uh-huh. But it was so palate-pleasing when people drink it that they were like, oh, it's spectacular. And they still come back and ask for it. And at that moment in time, I'm like, I'm going to hate this wine. It's absolutely nothing going on.
Right. But
context.
Exactly. Yeah. Context is everything. Let's tell people where your tasting room is and when they can
tasting room is downtown Lodi. We're right in front of the old arch down there at 6 West Pine Street. And we're open 7 days a week from noon until 5 p.m. And come on in. We're excited to see you. I have a great, great team in there. Everybody's very friendly and you'll have a great time.
It's actually one of the most popular tasting rooms in all of Lodi, and people just love what you're doing. And more information at jeremywineco.com, jeremywine.co.com. Yep. jeremywineco.com. Don't let me confuse you.
You can find it.
I do it.
And then find us on Instagram and Facebook too. That's probably the most actions happening on those two channels.
Absolutely. That's the world we live in. Absolutely. So it definitely worth seeking out. These are fantastic wines, and you can tell from listening to Jeremy, just the I don't even think passion comes close to describing your outlook on what you do. But what a blessing to have you in Lodi. I mean, of all the wine regions in the world, to be here is really to our benefit. And you're a lifelong Lodi guy.
Yeah, Lodi. And I think we've just scratched the surface of what we can do here.
Yeah, it's exciting. It really is. So check it out. Jeremy Wine Company. Jeremy Tredovic, thanks so much for being
my
guest.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate you. And thanks for doing the interviews.
Great. We'll do it again.
Yeah.
Thanks. Nice.